But are they putting themselves in longer-term peril? As the Israeli Prime Minister makes an unusual direct appeal to Iranians, I'll be talking about that. Later on, I'll be talking as well about conservatives, about squirrels, and about two huge moments in our industrial history, when today, the last blast furnace at Port Talbot in Wales and the last coal-fired power station in Britain in Nottinghamshire both closed. Are we walking towards a cleaner but colder country? All of that, plus a daring rescue in space. Join me after the news.
On your radio, on Global Player, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 6 o'clock, a spokesperson for the Israeli Defence Forces has refused to confirm to LBC whether Israel intends to launch a limited ground incursion into Lebanon.
Imminent is a means that it can happen any moment, and of course the IDF Defence Chief was speaking to forces just last week on Wednesday. And he said, yeah, your boots could be in Lebanon within days. We have a huge set of tools in our toolbox, including perhaps ground operations.
That's Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner. His comments come after American media said Israel had notified the US it intends to go in as soon as tonight. Unite has branded the thousands of job losses at one of the biggest steelworks in the world industrial vandalism. After more than 100 years, the last furnace at Tata Steel in Port Talbot shuts this evening. The UK's last remaining coal-fired power station near Nottingham is also closed today. The switch off at Ratcliffe-on-Soar brings an end to Britain's use of burning coal to produce energy. And the UK's top civil servant Simon Case has confirmed he'll step down at the end of the year on health grounds. There have been reports of tensions between Mr. Case and Sir Keir Starmer's Chief of Staff Sue Gray, but he says that has nothing to do with his decision. In the city, the FTSE 100 has closed down 50 points at 82.70. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.19. LBC weather staying wet and windy in the east of England overnight, drier with clear spells elsewhere and lows of 3 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Jenny Barsby.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation. It's 6 p.m. Now, tonight with Andrew Marr.
Good evening. All last week I was warning about the prospect of full-scale war in the Middle East, and today it seems to have started. After the explosive pager attacks and the assassination of the leader of Hezbollah, Israeli special forces began to move across the Lebanese border, and the tanks prepared for a full ground invasion. In a purely military sense, their operations so far have been brilliant. And by the way, I don't think we should regard the killing of Hezbollah leaders as particularly outrageous, compared to, for instance, the slaughter of civilian bystanders. In fact, if more countries at war with one another started off by trying to kill opposing leaders, rather than killing soldiers or bombing cities, then perhaps, you know, we would have fewer wars. But this is exactly the problem. Israel has killed so many people in Gaza and now in Lebanon that it's created a circle of hatred all around itself. Tomorrow's suicide bombers, tomorrow's enemies. For much of the world, the notion of Israel as a peaceable, democratic, cultured haven, the Israel so many of us admired for so long, is being pounded away in smoke and gunfire. From Brazil to South Africa, it's now seen as a ruthless, no-compromise military state, uninterested in the numbers of mere outsiders, Muslims or Palestinians or Lebanese, who die whenever it's threatened. And that is surely very dangerous for Israel. Again today, Britain's been calling for restraint. We might as well be singing songs to the wind to try to stop it from blowing. Longer term, whatever its stunning battlefield successes, I fear the state of Israel is playing a dangerous game with its very future. But then I'm a relentless optimist, and it was interesting that tonight Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed an appeal not to Israelis, but to Iranians.
With every passing moment, the regime is bringing you, the noble Persian people, closer to the abyss. The vast majority of Iranians know their regime doesn't care a whit about them. If it did care, if it cared about you, it would stop wasting billions of dollars on futile wars across the Middle East. It would start improving your lives.
Well, joining me now from the Conservative Conference in Birmingham is the former Cabinet Minister and Shadow Foreign Secretary, Andrew Mitchell. Andrew, great to have you on the show. Extraordinary, really, to hear Benjamin Netanyahu directly talking to the Iranian people. He seems to think that the entire region might be on the verge of a kind of revolution, particularly in countries like Syria and even in Iran itself.
Well, we must hope that is true, because the point that Netanyahu made about Iran and its regime not serving its people is one, I think, which we can all agree with and support. And, of course, we should remember tonight that Israel has the right of self-defense. After October the 8th, indeed on October the 8th, the first shells were sent over the border into northern Israel by Hezbollah. And they've been doing it ever since. And, you know, more than 70,000 people have had to leave their homes in northern Israel and have been unable to go back since that date. So I think, you know, we should be very clear that what is required now is for Hezbollah to lay down their weapons and retire behind the Litani River in accordance with UN Security Council Resolution 1701. And then for all of us in the international community to try and get everyone to focus on building on the Abraham Accords and looking at a comprehensive peace settlement for the Middle East. Never forget, Andy, that the progress at Oslo was made on the back of the Intifada.
It certainly was. Let me ask you about the current government, who have said, who have appealed for a ceasefire, appealed for a pause, and asked the Israelis not to launch a ground invasion of Lebanon. And that also appears to be the view of President Joe Biden. What's your view? Should they pause before they go ahead?
Well, Israel has the right of self-defense, and they are being shelled by Hezbollah over the border. Innocent women and children's lives are threatened as a result of Hezbollah, an internationally recognized terrorist regime prescribed by the United Kingdom and the European countries and by America. And they must stop. And if they won't stop, then Israel has the right of self-defense to stop them.
So if the tanks go over the border tonight, they do so with your support?
Well, they have to make the best judgment about how they exercise their right to self-defense. But I think it's very hard to argue, as I think a point you made in your opening introduction, that the world isn't a better place without the removal of the leader of Hezbollah. And remember, too, that Al-Qaeda and ISIL ceased really to be effective terrorist organizations when their leaders were removed. And the removal of the leader of Hezbollah, I hope, will cause Hezbollah to follow the same route.
Let me ask you also about the Lebanese foreign minister, who has said tonight that 56 Arab and Muslim countries will come together to guarantee Israel's security if Israel starts talks on a two-state solution with its capital in East Jerusalem. That seems to be a kind of offer that Israel would find it hard to brush aside easily.
It's a very encouraging development, but also remember Hezbollah is despised and detested in many parts of Lebanon. Many of us were so pleased to see yesterday that an Iranian plane bringing to Lebanon goodness knows what was turned back and not allowed to land. It is absolutely essential that Hezbollah now lay down their weapons and withdraw behind the Litani River, and I think everyone of goodwill will support the stopping of Hezbollah causing this mayhem in northern Israel.
The United States and the UK have both pleaded for restraint from Israel and have been so far completely ignored by Mr. Netanyahu, who clearly thinks he is winning militarily, you know, on the ground, forces effective and is working for him. What do you think his end game needs to be?
Well, it's perfectly clear, and it's been the objective of the British Conservative government, and I'm sure is the objective now of the Labour government and the Foreign Office, that we need to lift people's eyes when this ghastly situation ends and the firing and fighting stops to the political solution and the possibility of a regional settlement. That's why what the Lebanese foreign minister has said tonight is so important and attractive. But in terms of causing calling for a ceasefire, the right of Israel to defend itself, the right of it to deal with these rockets coming across from Hezbollah is not, I think, in dispute. And in anyone within the Israeli administration trying to work out how to act now, at this moment having a ceasefire when they've got Hezbollah on the run would seem to me to be a very surprising course of military action.
Andrew, picking up something that one of the possible future leaders of your party has said today, do you think people coming into the UK, into airports or ports or wherever, should see a Star of David as one of the first things they see?
Well, I think there are many things that they should see when they come into the airports, like the Britain is Great posters, which you see whenever you go through one of our major airports. And it's always, to me, a matter of pride to see that.
Yes, and Robert Jenrick has said there should be a Star of David there to show our absolute support for Israel under all circumstances. Do you agree with him?
Well, Britain is a staunch ally of Israel. It was British men and women in the military and British weaponry that was used to defend Israel when Iran was lobbing rockets directly from Iran into Israel. And there should be no doubt about our support for Israel.
I think that was a very elegant and loquacious no, if I may say so. Thank you very much indeed, Andrew Mitchell. Now let's talk next to an unusual American diplomat. Jeffrey Feltman has served all over, including the United States Embassy in Tel Aviv, as well as being his country's ambassador in Lebanon. Since then, he has announced his support for Palestinian statehood, and he joins me now. Very, very good to see you there, Mr. Feltman. Can I ask you also about Ayman Stefadi, the foreign minister of Jordan, his statement today when he said on the fringes of the United Nations that 56 Arab and Muslim countries want to come together to guarantee the security of Israel in return for Israel accepting the need for Palestinian statehood and a two-stage state solution. What do you make of that? Is this a significant moment, do you think?
I think this is an opportunity. But looking more narrowly at that initiative, what I find interesting is that the Lebanese government has now put space between its position and Hezbollah's position. Hezbollah, as your previous speaker has noted, has said that they will continue to fire into Israel despite the losses until there's a ceasefire in Gaza. The Lebanese government is now saying, we want to be part of the implementation of that Security Council resolution from 2006, which is clearing the area of southern Lebanon from all armed elements except for the Lebanese armed forces. So I think there's an opportunity now for diplomacy because you have a distinction between the government of Lebanon and Hezbollah in terms of their approaches to how you end this war.
I was asking at the top of the show, I don't know if you could hear it, about what the end game might be for Israel and whether huge military success might end up with, as it were, political failure. But your answer to that seems to be that we are quite close to a proper peaceful ending of this very, very long-running conflict to the north of Israel.
I wish I could say that. I wish I could agree with that. What I'm saying is that there's an opportunity now that I don't think that we've had before, where the Lebanese government has basically hidden behind Hezbollah's positions. Now there's a distinction between the two. When I look at Israel, I think that you have a confluence of Israel's strategic objectives of rebalancing the forces in the Middle East, of trying to put Iran on its back foot. The tactical goals, which is to find a way to allow the people who had to leave their homes in northern Israel to go home, and Netanyahu's self-political interest. You know, Netanyahu has been widely loathed by his population for a number of reasons, trying to overthrow the judiciary, the lack of any kind of preparedness or understanding before the October 7th massacre. But now he's got the Israeli public with him on the idea of hitting back against Hezbollah. So hitting back against Hezbollah strategically tries to rebalance the forces of the Middle East. It tactically tries to clear the area so that people can go back to their homes, and politically helps Netanyahu revive his forces inside Israel.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it's going to work. We saw in 1982 and in 2006, Israel starts off very, very strongly, but doesn't always end up with the results that they intended.
the wise words. We saw, of course, big crowds mourning the death of Nasrallah in Lebanon, but also big crowds celebrating it in Syria, where the anti-Assad Syrians are absolutely with what the Israelis have done. Do you think we are quite close to some kind of general sort of revolutionary transformation of the Middle East, given what's happening?
I don't think so. And I don't think so for a couple of reasons. One is inside Lebanon, where this could happen, I think you're going to see caution, reticence. The Lebanese have been through civil war. They know what happened after the Israeli invasion in 1982 when the Christians asserted their power, only to have Bashir Jamal, the Christian president, assassinated later, bloodletting on all sides. I think the Lebanese are going to be very, very cautious. In a way that they might lose this opportunity. There's a vacuum right now for leadership in Lebanon. Vacuums do not last. And now is the time for the Lebanese to come together and try to build a consensus behind a president that could be a president for all of Lebanon. Lebanon's had a presidential vacuum since November of 2022 because of polarization in the parliament. Bring together the people that came out into the street back in 2019. You may remember that the Lebanese had very compelling demonstrations to try to change their system in 2019. That was snuffed out both by Hezbollah fighters on the street as well as by the financial collapse. Mm-hmm. I think now Lebanon has an opportunity to come together to try to fix the system, to have Lebanon become a state again, now that the state within the state, Hezbollah, has been weakened. But I'm rather pessimistic that this will happen because I think people will tend to be cautious for fear of setting off a sectarian war.
Well, still on the cautious side, I suppose, is there not a danger that if possibly later on today Israel launches a full-scale ground invasion of southern Lebanon, that war atmosphere, as it were, ends any possibility of an independent Lebanese position, of them distancing themselves from Hezbollah? The emotions of being attacked take over.
Yes, I mean, I saw this in 2006. I was the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon in 2006, and When Hezbollah launched the cross-border raid in 2006, killing and kidnapping Israeli soldiers inside Israel, triggering that war, the majority of Lebanese were furious. The majority of Lebanese said, why in the world did Hezbollah drag us into a war? We didn't, we did not vote for war. Hezbollah has brought us into an adventure that we had no say in, and it's affecting our lives. It's ruining our economy and our summer. After the Israelis invasion began, the ground invasion began and moved northward, then you saw solidarity among the Lebanese against the Israelis. And I expect that we'll see the same thing now, that even those Lebanese who are relieved that they're no longer hostage to Hassan Nasrallah will not welcome the Israeli ground invasion. They've seen that movie before, and they really don't want to see the sequel.
They have indeed. I find that very illuminating. I'm sure everybody listening did as well. Mr. Feltman, thank you so much for talking to me. Now, coming up, the first ever coal-fired power station was built here in the late Victorian era, and today marked the closure of the last one. With that and the closure of the Port Talbot Steelworks, it has been a historic day, a sad day for British industry, and we're going to discuss both of those stories next. You are listening to Tonight with Andrew Marr, and the time is now 6:17.
This is LBC.
Hello, you. High energy bills that keep changing can leave you feeling powerless. At Uswitch, our energy experts are working hard to bring you lower prices, exclusive deals, and more choice. Fix your deal now and take the power back. Uswitch, we put you first.
Making mochi at a homestay in Japan. Finding the best banh mi in Hanoi with the help of a local. Camping with wildlife rangers in South Africa. The best parts of travel happen when you find yourself in that place, at that moment, with those people. And a small group tour with Intrepid Travel will bring you plenty of those moments. For thousands of experiences in over 100 countries, visit intrepidtravel.com. Only Intrepid.
Tonight with Andrew Marr. Watch live on Global Player. This is LBC.
It's 6:18. Simon Case, the Cabinet Secretary and head of the civil service, who has served under four prime ministers, is to resign. It's been announced this afternoon. We thought he was going at the end of the year on medical advice. He's got a neurological condition. So he seems to be going early, and this gives Keir Starmer the opportunity to appoint his own person at the top of the system. But these being rocky days for the new government, is it all good news, really? Let's speak now to LBC's political editor, Natasha Clark. Natasha, can you just talk me through the role of the Cabinet Secretary? Who is this guy? Why is it so important?
Andrew, £200,000 a year to be the top civil servant in government. It's a huge role. And like you said, Simon Case obviously leaving is going to pose possibly a challenge for the new government, but a huge opportunity too to get their man at the head of the civil service. And Simon Case, it's fair to say, has obviously been dogged and dragged into government's past and, of course, previous. You'll remember his text to the COVID inquiry that revealed some of the frustrations that he had with Boris Johnson at the time. That's probably how he is best known to the public. However, in recent weeks, he's been wrapped up in some of these briefing wars around Downing Street, around Sue Gray. One MP last week even accused him of actually leaking some of those details about Sue Gray's salary. That was obviously furiously denied by 10 Downing Street at the time. But yes, some very frustrating texts emerged from his time at the heart of government. They were given to the COVID inquiry about exactly what he thought about Boris Johnson. So those are the two things you might know about him. But he has a huge role overseeing all of the thousands of civil servants that work up and down the country. And of course, for this new government, for Keir Starmer to deliver it, that's going to be hugely important. And we've just actually got the job specification for this, Andrew, which has just been released, and I wanted to sort of pick up a few bits. If you're interested in applying, Andrew... if you're interested in applying, you can submit no more than 2 pages of A4 sized sheets, 1,000 words, explaining why this appointment interests you and how you can evidence your suitability for the role. So £2,000 a year. You've got a huge pension contribution as well. Of course, 30 days.
£200,000 a year.
£200,000 a year. Yeah. You do have to commit a diversity questionnaire. So you and I, Andrew, may not quite meet that specification. But look, head of the civil service for Keir Starmer's government, he is obviously going to push ahead with such a huge reforming agenda. He's going to need someone who sees eye to eye with him, who's going to be on the same page, and who's not going to be afraid to ruffle a few feathers in that mission.
Well, I'm not sure that you could take the pay cut, Natasha, but thank you very, very much for enlightening us on this very important story tonight. Now then, politicians talk and the little scandals go zipping round and round, but below and behind all of that, we're changing dramatically as a country. Two stories just from today. The final closure of the last Port Talbot blast furnace in South Wales and the end of a long tradition of Welsh steelmaking, at least for the time being. And second, no more coal smoke in the winter wind, no more rumble of nutty slack, no more mushrooming of slag heaps, no more cities and towns turning an impressive dense black, no more pit villages, no more Arthur Scargill. Yes, today, the last coal-fired power station in Britain at Ratcliffe-on-Soar in Nottinghamshire was closed down. For more than 140 years, we've been using coal, on which so much of Britain rests, to create electricity, though, of course, we've been mining it for much longer than that. That goes back to at least Roman Britain. So this is the end of a long, long story. In a moment, we'll talk about Port Talbot, Wales and steel. But let's start off with the end of coal-fired power stations with Dr. Ashat Ratti, senior reporter, Bloomberg News, and author of Climate Capitalism. Very good to have you here, Dr. Ratti.
Nice to be here.
This is a very emotional moment. The playwright, Mr. Stewart, has said that, James Stewart, has said that those huge cooling towers we see where we pass on the train, I think there's 7 of them, should be saved for the nation. But just talk us through how big a moment this is for British generation generally.
Huge, because as you said, 1882 is when the first coal power plant was created. World's first, I have to say, here in the UK.
In London, I think.
In London.
It?
And the use of coal really rapidly rose after that. At one point, the UK was not just consuming coal for electricity, railways, steel making, heating homes, but also exporting coal. It was the Saudi Arabia of coal in the early 20th century. And so to see where coal usage, which is almost down to nothing, and of course in electricity, it ends today, is quite historic.
And this is really the consequence of a policy started 10 years ago to get rid of it, isn't it?
You would say it's actually a 50-year story because there are sort of four big steps that take place for electricity from coal to go to zero. So the first step is that you find alternative sources. So you have nuclear, you have gas, and in more recent years, you've got a lot of renewables, hydropower, but also wind and solar power.
Yeah.
The second is that you don't build new coal power plants. The last new coal power plant to have been built was 1986. There was a chance that one more would have been built in 2009 or 2010, but there was lots of opposition. And turned out that was actually an economically sensible thing to do, to not build a new coal power plant in 2010. But Germany did build and is now still burning coal.
And of course, China's building lots of them.
Lots of it. Mm. And then the third one, as you said, is right. Over the past decade, actually a little more, 15 years, the UK government has been quite clear about where it wants its electricity mix to go. And so that's given industry and the power regulator to really find the other sources and then bring this plan to
now, being an idle youth, I've been browsing across social media and lots of people there are saying, but what about the days when you get very, very cold weather, periods of really cold weather? Are we not in danger of not having enough security of supply, not enough diversity of supply? Do they have a point?
They do. And that's why this has been a decade long plan, because for the government, if there are blackouts, think about the political headlines that are going to come through.
Absolutely.
For the regulator who's been planning this, think about what kind of impact they're going to get through. So, yes, they've been planning for reliability all along. Coal has been replaced by two things. Renewables, yes, they are intermittent, but also gas, which is available most of the time.
So now, if the wind doesn't blow or whatever, the sun doesn't shine, which is the season we're coming into, it's really gas that will keep us going. And so the big question then is, what happens when we stop using gas? Because that is also, you know, a non-renewable.
Indeed. And so there are two things that are being planned alongside. It's not just the fact that we have power production in the UK, but the UK is more and more interconnected to the European grid. So you get a lot of nuclear power coming from France, you get a lot of electricity from Norway, from hydropower coming through. So that's one way in which you can get electricity when there are, say, windless days in the UK. The other one is storage. You are able to store electricity either in sort of pumped hydro, so you take water, put it up in a reservoir, and then pump it down, or in batteries, and those are getting more and more used. There's also biomass. So the Drax power plant, which used to burn coal, now burns wood. So there's a combination, a diversity of sources that you need to be able to ensure affordability and reliability.
Passing what you're saying, is it basically, don't worry, there will not come a time when you flick the switch down and the light doesn't come on. There is enough diversity in the system.
I think that is the job of the government. And if the government can't assure people that that's the guarantee that is on offer, I don't think climate goals or net zero targets or shutting down these gas power plants will be very popular.
They certainly would not. Mr. Ratti, thank you very much indeed for talking to me. Let's turn now to the other closure story. Tata, the Indian owner of the steelmaking works at Port Talbot in Wales, is switching in around 2 years' time to a less polluting electric arc furnace, which will convert scrap steel into the usable kind. But meanwhile, the last of the old blast furnaces using liquid iron closes today with plumes of red steam and a sense of deep sadness in the community where around 2,800 jobs will be lost. I'm joined now by the leader of the Labour Group of the Neath Port Talbot Council, Councillor Rob Jones. Councillor Jones, great to have you on the show. A very, very sad day for your community.
Yes, thank you, Andrew. Thank you for inviting me. Yes, I've akined it to actually attending the funeral. That's the level of feeling within the community.
We've all seen the pictures on television and elsewhere of the Port Talbot steelworks, those huge, huge blast furnaces, the steam pouring off it. Tell me a little bit about Port Talbot, the community around it.
Majority of Port Talbot is linked in some way and somehow to the steelworks. It's a complete community built around the steelworks. Although Port Talbot existed for many, many years, it has been built up and known as Steel Town. There is not one person that you can speak to is not some way connected with working in the steelworks, have relationships, neighbours. This is historical and generations and it impacts on the wider community. People shop in the local areas, the service industries provide the scaffolders, the painters, the lubricators as contractors going in there. So this has a major impact on the wider community.
It's going to be devastating. Now, of course, there is the new electric arc furnace coming in about 2 years' time, I think. And as a country, we're clearly going to need a lot of steel, not least for the wind farms that everybody talks about. How much, as it were, optimism and resilience is there in the community about getting some of those jobs back in a couple of years' time?
I think, realistically, very little. You mentioned about in 2 years, it'll take 2 years for the planning application to go through. It'll take another 2 years for it to be built. The dichotomy we have locally is that currently blast furnace made iron can produce so many grades of steel from top quality right down to basic, whereas the electric arc furnaces do not produce that level of steel. And the hypocrisy here is that in order for electric arc furnaces to actually produce good quality, top quality steel, it needs a thing called pig iron. And pig iron can only be produced by blast furnaces and exported from around the world to make sure that we can produce the top quality grades of steel that we currently produce with blast furnace.
So this is a political nonsense, really, in your view?
It's not so much a political nonsense, but to badge it as a green energy and climate control. Everyone agrees we've got to do something with carbon emissions. Where it doesn't make sense on a local level is, why are we closing two blast furnaces that produce the best steel that basically is in the world in order to produce an electric arc furnace when parts of the component to create that steel comes from India that have recently opened a blast furnace and have plans to build two more? So how are we going to affect climate change by closing these blast furnaces and losing 2,800 jobs?
We're losing jobs here and importing, as it were, the climate-changing technologies and materials from elsewhere.
Yes, and it's increasing the carbon footprint of steel in this country by about a metric ton. Going up into changing the carbon climate that we've currently got. So it logistically, to badge it as green energy is silly, because we need the imported steel.
I don't understand these things, but it seems bonkers to me. Is the community getting enough support in terms of retraining and supporting people who've lost their jobs today?
The government has produced £80 million and Tata has matched that with a £20 million input, creating a transition board of £100 million. This is to make sure that the transition going from blast furnace into electric arc is used within the community to retrain. The local authority has got a priority job interview for those that wish to come and try and get employment with the local authority. But it goes nowhere near to replacing the £200 million projected costs of the input of what we're going to lose as a community. So if we go back and look at the miners' strikes, not one community from the miners' strikes have actually ever recovered from 1984 going forward. The picture is very bleak for recovery of anywhere near the infrastructure, the input, the investment within our communities. The money is just not enough.
A sad way to end. All of our best, everyone in Port Talbot. Councillor Jones, thank you very much indeed for talking to LBC. Coming up in a few moments, we'll talk about migration and the argument from Kemi Badenoch that some cultures aren't as valid as others. But we're not going to talk about it in the way you might expect. The time now is 6:32 and Jenny Barsby has your news.
Joe Biden's again called for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah, as there are mixed reports that Israeli troops are about to launch a limited ground incursion into Lebanon. The president's also confirmed he's sending a few thousand additional troops to the Middle East to boost security. Traditional steel making has now come to an end in South Wales after more than 100 years. The last furnace at Tata Steel in Port Talbot has shut this evening with the loss of thousands of jobs. And the threat of teacher strikes at schools in England could be over. Members of the National Education Union have this evening backed the government's 5.5% pay rise. LBC weather staying wet and windy in the east overnight, clear elsewhere with lows of 3 degrees.
LBC This Morning on Nick Ferrari at Breakfast.
Kemi Badenoch sparking a furious row yesterday for suggesting that statutory maternity pay is excessive. Lisa's in Rochester. Is that right? You're on maternity leave now, Lisa?
Yes,
well, congratulations. How long ago did you have the baby?
Just under 4 months. He's 4 months tomorrow. So I think the point that people tend to kind of forget when they're talking about maternity pay and mums kind of getting, quote unquote, 3 months, is we are literally creating the workforce that's going to be working in the next 20 to 30 years. So mums may now make a decision that, look, I can't afford to go on maternity pay or go on maternity leave. I can't afford to have children, which I think a lot of people are doing.
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast, back tomorrow morning from 7.
With Betfair, where odds move faster than polls. Play responsibly.
LBC.
Buy parts of a new wind farm and generate your own low-cost greener energy with Ripple. Joining Ripple could cut your energy bills every year for decades. Without the hassle of getting solar panels installed onto your home or business. Your own energy to wherever you live. Even if you move home. That's real climate action to be proud of. Join now to be part of our next wind farm. Welcome to Ripple. Ripple Energy.
The British Airways end of summer sale has landed. Just as you're about to return to the chaos of weekday mornings. First gear for miles down the motorway. Piles of paperwork, quick or nothing dinners, commutes with no personal space. You deserve another break. Find thousands of flights and holidays in the British Airways end of summer sale. Subject to availability. Sale ends 1st of October. Holidays are ATOL protected. Terms and conditions apply. Visit ba.com/sale.
Love my Toyota Corolla. I do. Love it.
The Corolla's nice and comfy. My kids love it.
Slow maintenance. Looks great. Worth every penny.
My Corolla is great. Yeah. Plenty of room for my kit. Toyota Corolla may no board for Sunday. Ehi meri baili garsi. Ehi me horn chalondiya.
For 50 million drivers everywhere, there's one clear choice. Search Toyota Corolla to see why it's the world's favorite car. To verify, visit toyota.co.uk/Corolla data.
Tonight, with Andrew Marr. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
6:35. Now, there are some of you I know who think that I might be in some way biased against Conservatives. This is unfair and frankly hurtful, and I'm going to prove you wrong. If I was brimming with bias, I'd bring you a report on Liz Truss at their conference in Birmingham today. But no, too cheap, too easy, too predictable. Instead, we're going to talk about migrants and about whether all cultures are equally valid. But no, I'm not talking about Kemi Badenoch's comments. We're instead going straight now to discuss the fight back of red squirrels, who have made significant gains overtaking the grey squirrel population in Aberdeen, with Nicole Still, Programme Manager for Saving Scotland's Red Squirrels. Nicole, let's remind ourselves the grey squirrels came here relatively recently as migrants from North America, is that right?
Yeah, I suppose migrants isn't necessarily the correct term. So grey squirrels are an invasive non-native species in the UK.
An invasive non-native species. And why, for people who haven't followed this story, have they so effectively obliterated red squirrels across most of the United Kingdom?
Sure. So there's a few different reasons that allow them to be so invasive. In the first instance, they outcompete our native red squirrels for both food and resource. But they also importantly carry the squirrelpox virus, which they carry asymptomatically, but is quite deadly to our local red populations.
And, you know, those of us brought up on Beatrix Potter books of gorgeous red squirrels feel very emotional about this. I do. I'm very much in favour of the reds against the greys, if I can put it that way, though I'm sure there's lots of people who love grey squirrels just as much. But can you explain how in Aberdeen you have turned the tide? Because it's been accepted up to now that there is really no way that the red squirrels can survive with grey squirrel populations, except in very, very, very remote areas.
Yeah, so our work in Aberdeen has been really successful, and it's a great example of what the results of hard work can do, especially in the fight against invasive non-native species. So all of the grey squirrels in Aberdeen were first introduced in a single introduction event back in 1971. And since then, that population of just about 10 squirrels has expanded to over 10,000. The project's been working in Aberdeen since 2009 to remove those invasive non-native grey squirrels. And to date, we are down to what we believe to be certainly less than 100, potentially much closer to 10 to 20 gray squirrels left in the city. And that's come in the on the backside of the return of reds all the way down into the very center of Aberdeen City itself.
Now, you use that word, Nicole, getting rid of them or removing them. What does removing them actually mean? Does it mean killing them? Does it mean trapping them and taking them somewhere else? How do you remove them?
So, unfortunately, it does mean killing. Gray squirrels as an invasive species mean that they're a human-created problem and that requires a human solution. So we do carry out live trapping. We hold ourselves to the absolute highest standards of animal welfare to do this. And we use a process of live trapping, and in some cases, not in Aberdeen, but elsewhere in the project, free shooting. And these are considered the most humane methods of animal control and animal dispatch for squirrels, according to an EU panel on animal welfare and health.
All right. Some people listening will find that slightly upsetting that so many grey squirrels are being killed and will ask themselves, is it really worth saving red squirrels if it means killing that number of grey squirrels?
So the very quick answer is absolutely yes. It's not something that we enjoy doing. You'll clock from my accent. I come from America just like the grey squirrels, so I understand how charismatic and how important they can be in people's day-to-day lives. But that being said, they're not part of our native ecosystems. They have a significant impact on our native forests, both our woodlands and our commercial forest interests, and as we've talked about, our native red species. So it's really important and that we carry that work out. And we understand that people might not agree with it, but we only carry it out where we know it's going to have the greatest impact and where we can make a significant improvement and impact on the red squirrel populations.
So you've done it in Aberdeen. Where next?
So we have a national strategy in Scotland. Aberdeen is absolutely a really crucial part of that, and it's taught us a lot of lessons over the past 10 years about what we can achieve, particularly in urban areas. So there is ambitions over the, certainly not the next few years, but in the longer term, that we can start implementing that in other key urban areas throughout Scotland and ultimately help to restore red squirrels, not just through the rest of the Central Belt, and through the central lowlands of Scotland, but potentially across the whole of Scotland down the road.
That's really interesting. So one day Scotland could be grey squirrel free, and then presumably the reds will march south across the border.
Absolutely. So we actually do have some red squirrels still in the south of Scotland, as well as in the north of England. And so there's some really important work done through our project, as well as partners and volunteers to help secure those populations. But it's all part of this longer-term national strategy about returning reds throughout Scotland and throughout much northern England.
One final point, Nicole. You said right at the beginning that grey squirrels were able to compete with red squirrels by getting more food and basically starving them out. Why is that? Are they brighter? Do they work harder? What's the secret?
No, so there's a few reasons. They are larger than our native red species, and that does give them a bit of an edge when it comes to competing for resource in the moment. What's interesting is they can actually consume a lot of our the native food sources, so things like acorns, much earlier in the year than our reds. So things like acorns have high levels of tannins. Gray squirrels can better consume those and eat those resources before the red squirrels can get to them when they're ripe enough for our reds.
And presumably the red squirrels have evolved to allow, you know, the native species, the trees and others, to grow safely by not eating the nuts and the berries too early in the year. That's really, really interesting, Nicole. A very, very important story, as I say, about migration and culture and all of that. Thank you very much indeed for talking to me. So, are we not going to talk about the Tory conference at all? Of course we will. LBC's political correspondent Aggie Chambray has been in Birmingham observing this afternoon's interviews by two of the leading contenders to take over the leadership of the Conservative Party, Tom Tugendhat and Kemi Badenoch. Aggie, in short, who is the more impressive performer?
Good question. Well, Andrew, it is, of course, day two of Tory conference and 87 days since the Tory leadership race officially began. It feels like it's been a little longer than that. I think the
more impressive performer today was Tom Tugendhat, and I partly say that because it was a surprise, not just in the way he performed in the hall, but also the way he was received by those watching, and not just those watching, but those around the conference centre as well. He's sort of not seen as someone who has been a bookies' favourite, unlike perhaps Kemi Badenoch, but actually I think he is doing well, he's being received well by Tory members. And he, of course, went first today, and he was, sort of began with fairly muted applause, but actually really managed to grab the attention of the crowd on a few occasions with big applause and big laughs too. I thought one of the most interesting things he was saying was he refused to say whether or not he'd reintroduce winter fuel allowance, and so did Kemi Badenoch, which is quite interesting considering the opposition the Tories have put Labour under since they announced that policy. And he also said that his job was to reform the Conservative Party, not to become reform, sort of twisting away from the right of the party as well. And also talked about how they've eroded trust in themselves and need to rebuild trust in the Conservative Party. Now,
Aggie, tell me,
Kemi Badenoch was...
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was going to ask you to tell me more about Tom Tugendhat, actually, because, you know, he has this rather owlish demeanour. You know, he's a quietly spoken guy and all the rest of it. I am just fascinated by the idea that he outshone Kemi Badenoch, who everyone says, you know, is the standout star of the contest.
It's interesting. I think he did it sort of because it's a bit of a surprise. And I thought actually she did well in that room, but sort of began almost nervously because she's had this sort of difficult 24 hours after she made these comments where she said maternity pay was excessive, which she's then had to slightly row back on and say that she'd been misconstrued there. And so I felt like she did warm up, but it felt like he had more control over the room, at least initially. And she did seem to be confident, but actually there was a moment where she was slightly strained and seemed kind of cross with the interviewer when she was asked about the fact that some see her as brittle and irritable. And she asked, well, who says that? The conversation quickly moved on.
I say that.
But you know... but it's interesting here because I just mentioned we're 87 days into this contest. We've still got 33 days to go. But you would think, and in previous Tory contests, it's been so clear so early on who would win. And that is not the case here. It does feel conceivable that any one of these four, and we will hear from Robert Jenrick, we'll hear from James Cleverly in that kind of format tomorrow, any of the four still could win, which seems like a strange place to be after we've had 87 full days of this contest. And I think part of the reason that there's been frustration yesterday that came into the open about the contest being so long was because of this. They feel like it should be cut down and just a little bit shorter, and the format should be changed.
Now, Aggie, you're going to have to explain to people, but some commentators have said there's quite a lot of dirty tricks going on in this contest, and particularly that the other candidates all want to knock Kemi Badenoch out relatively early because they think that she would win in front of the membership. Tell me a little bit about what's going on behind the scenes.
Well, Kemi Badenoch herself said on stage today that there was a Stop Kemi campaign, but she also continued there was a Stop Everyone campaign, a Stop James campaign, a Stop Rob campaign. So she clearly believes that is going on. And I think there have previously in other Tory contests definitely been dirty tricks going on, definitely vote lending. I am told by every camp, I have to say, that they don't think there is vote lending going on, at least at this stage. Someone called the idea of that mad because there are so few votes in it. Obviously, they're only expecting 119 Tory MPs to actually vote. So there is, I think, a little bit too much nervousness about vote lending. At least that is what they're saying. But in terms of dirty tricks, there's definitely a kind of suppressed grins around conference about the fact that Kemi Badenoch has had to spend the last 24 hours and this crucial time during conference defending those comments and saying she was misconstrued. And I'm told that one camp actually was up drinking late into the night, looking pretty pleased with themselves. So I think it definitely feels like the claws are out. I mean, one Tory source said to me today, when talking about Kemi Badenoch, the reason that she's losing supporters, they say she's losing supporters, is because nobody likes her. I mean, that's the kind of language that's flowing around the conference while everyone's pretending to play nice.
Pretty direct. And for people who haven't been paying attention all the way through, and why should they be, in a sense, this is only one stage of the campaign. There's still quite a long way to go, Aggie, before we get down to the final two. And it's Tory MPs.
So it's interesting you say that, Andrew, because it is Tory MPs. We are at the moment, we've got these four candidates, and then next week it'll be whittled down to two, and it'll be whittled down by MPs. But it does feel like the conversation, I suppose, as you'd expect at Tory conference, is very much about the members today. It's about the members over conference. But they've got to remember that actually they are still trying to get the MPs to vote for them, at least in this next stage. And then following on from that, after next week, there'll be two people left. And then when there's two people left, it will then go down to the members. And then on November the 2nd, the members get their vote and they will finally choose their leader.
Aggie Chambray there showing absolutely no signs of confidence fatigue. So good for her. Now, coming up, two astronauts are being rescued by Elon Musk's SpaceX company after being trapped on the International Space Station since June. But what must it have been like for them up there? We will talk about life on the station with its former commander. The time is now 6:48.
Coming up at 7, Ian Dale, leading Britain's conversation, next on LBC. The US election, explained on LBC.
With Betfair, play responsibly.
I'm John Sopel, host of the global original Newsagents USA podcast. In the upcoming US election, it's not simply decided by which candidate gets the most votes nationwide, but it's the Electoral College that actually votes for the president. The Electoral College is a process as opposed to a physical place. There are 538 electors, which makes 270 the magic number needed for victory. The electors are divided into the 50 states, each state's number of electors based on population, with the vast majority of them voting on a winner-takes-all basis. This means that both Harris and Trump must be tactical with where they campaign, as this election will come down to just a few swing states in their race for 270.
The US election, explained on LBC.
With Betfair, everyone knows the polls, experts know the odds. Play responsibly.
LBC.
Hey, you. You, with the hands at 10 and 2. Ever felt that nudge that your motor might need a little TLC? When it's time to go under the hood, eBay's got you covered. From mirrors to headlights, find all the right parts by entering your reg. And if it doesn't fit, eBay Assured Fit means you can return it for free. That's our money-back pledge. Find the right part at the right price with eBay Assured Fit. Exclusions apply. See ebay.co.uk for more details.
This is LBC. Message Andrew Marr on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
And it is 6:50. If you're a hospitality business owner, listen up, because the way you pay your staff will be changing tomorrow. The Tipping Act is becoming effective from tomorrow, ensuring that more than 2 million workers, mostly from the hospitality industry, receive a fair share of tips collected by their businesses. Here to discuss what that change means for workers is Tim Sharp, the Senior Employment Rights Policy Officer at the TUC. Tim, great to have you on the show. Now, this is a legislation which came from the previous Conservative government, actually. And it's regulations, but it is legally binding. Just explain how it works.
So under the new rules, employers will have to pass on 100% of tips. So no taking off
no
credit
creaming
cards.
Off. Yeah.
No taking credit card charges or any of those other things. They'll be able to take off tax and that's it. So they'll have to be passing on all the tips and service charges. They'll have to be distributing them in a fair, consistent, transparent manner. And they'll have to be paying them by the end of the month after the month that they were received. So it should mean a big change in life for a number of hospitality workers.
Now, we're talking about huge numbers of people, of course, not just people pulling pints behind the bar, but restaurant staff, hairdressers and many more. There's been a long tradition of giving people cash as tips because many of us did not believe that the business concerned would actually pass them on. Is there much evidence that people were simply not getting the, you know, you see the 12% or whatever it is on your bill and that lots of businesses weren't passing it on? Is this a big problem?
It is a big problem. And now this legislation affects tips that are controlled by the employer. So tips are paid by credit card, some cash tips, but not cash tips given sort of directly to the server. But the evidence gathered by the last government was quite clear. I think about half of workers had tips withheld in some way. Sometimes they didn't get it at all. Sometimes employers are creaming off money. So it's been a long running problem, and it's taken a long campaign to get to this stage. I think the first time ministers saw evidence was back in 2013. And if you consider that something like £200 million of tips were going astray each year. That's a lot of money that hasn't gone to hospitality workers, who are not among the best paid workers in the economy. Mm.
Absolutely right. Let me ask you about the enforcement side of this, because presumably what now needs to happen, may have to happen this week, is that an employer, restaurant owner or whoever, or a hairdresser owner, gets the staff together, looks them in the eye and say, the rules have changed. As of next month, you will get, you know, a certain amount of money in your salary coming from the tips, and that is guaranteed. But for those who don't do that, for those who carry on trying to keep the money away from their staff, what kind of enforcement is there?
Staff will be able to go to an employment tribunal, and the tribunal will be able to award up to £5,000 and payment of tips. So it's really key here that workers are aware of their rights. There are trade unions organising in this sector who will try and make sure that workers know what their rights are. But you know, a lot of people, it's quite high turnover. A lot of people are in non-unionised places. So it's really important that as many people as possible know what their rights are.
And as you say, we're talking about people who very often are pretty badly paid in the first place. So what kind of sums of money are people not getting that they ought to be getting in the course of an average week or month?
Well, it's been estimated that the workers are on average losing out to the tune of about £200 a year, which is a little bit different for different workers, but it's a huge amount of money for people on relatively low wages. But I think it's also important that this is just the first step in these reforms. It's taken a long time to get to this place, but employers can still exert some control over the trunk that helps distribute decide where tips go in some cases at some employers. And we still have workers in very insecure arrangements. So if you're on a 0 hours contract, for example, you might be worried about demanding the employer hands you over your share of tips because you don't know if your shift that's due tomorrow will be taken off you. And likewise, lots of workers who don't qualify for unfair dismissal protection for the first couple of years. So there's still a lot to be done to ensure that workers in a really important sector of the economy get the sort of protection and get the pay that they deserve.
Now, this is not directly a TUC matter, I guess, but what about the actual size of tips, the percentage? Because we are not a very big tipping culture generally, certainly not compared with the Americans, for whom a 15 or 20% tip in lots of circumstances would be absolutely expected and indeed demanded by people. Here we're much more reticent. What do you think about the culture of tipping in this country?
I think there's something to be said about the culture of pay in this country. We think that hospitality workers should be paid a fair wage and that any tips should come on top. What it shouldn't be the case is that people who are dining at a restaurant or going to the pub are somehow subsidising what the employer should be paying out of their share. So yes, please do tip hospitality workers well, but also employers should be doing their bit and ensuring that this becomes a sector where people are rewarded well for the effort they put in.
Here, here and here again, Tim Sharp of the TUC, thank you very much for talking to LBC. Now next, a good news story. Two astronauts who've been stuck on the International Space Station are being rescued by a Dragon SpaceX capsule, an extraordinary looking thing which has docked at the space station with a couple of spare seats and is expected to bring them back to Earth in February. Let's talk now to Chris Hadfield, a former astronaut and commander of the International Space Station, joining us from Stag Island in Corunna, Ontario. Thank you very much indeed, Commander, if I can call you that. Just tell me a little bit about conditions on the space station. These guys have been up for a long time. They're going to be up there for many months to come.
Hi, Andrew. Yeah, you used the word trapped and rescued, and neither of those are true. They've always had a ride home. And this is what astronauts do for a living, is we train for decades and risk our lives flying rockets so that we can live and work on board a space station. So, in fact, for the two astronauts that you're referring to, for Butch and Sonny, this is the best thing that could have possibly happened to them. Instead of just staying up for a week or two, they're actually going to be up there for an entire full increment. And in fact, Sonny is the commander of the space station right now. So it's
loving
it's been badly misrepresented in the press.
Well, shame on me for misrepresenting it myself. But I come back to my original question. Just give me a sense of, you know, how spacious is it? What do you do all day? Are you working constantly on scientific experiments? Is there much time to stare downwards at the small blue globe below? You're there for a very long time. It must affect almost everything. Biorhythms, health, you know, psychology, the lot.
We run about 200 experiments simultaneously on the space station, and there are 11 people up there right now. Four of them are coming back next week, so they'll be down to a regular crew of seven. It's an enormous amount of work. Your alarm goes off, you have a quick briefing with all the mission controls around the world, and then you basically work 16-hour days, 7 days a week. And nowhere on your schedule, Andrew, does it say, go look out the window. But so what you're trying to do is get ahead of the schedule so you have the tremendous human privilege of floating to the window and seeing our world in its unfettered reality. You go around the world 16 times a day. I've been around it 2,650 times. It is the most beautiful, awe-inspiring, informative sight a human being can see.
Well, what a lovely way to end the show and the interview, Mr. Hadfield. Thank you so much for talking to me tonight. And do keep an eye out for Chris's speaking tour of the UK next year as well. I'll be back with you tomorrow. If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back on Catch Up on Global Player, where you can also pause and rewind live radio, as well as listen to a range of podcasts. Download now for free from your app store or head to globalplayer.com. Coming up at 10 on LBC, it's Ben Kentish. But right now, it's time for Ian Dale.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Well, a ground invasion of Lebanon by the Israelis looks to be ever closer as the airstrikes continue. President Biden says he hopes an invasion doesn't happen, but seems unwilling to tell the Israelis what any consequences might be if they go ahead. How should the West respond if there is indeed a ground invasion in the near future? At 8 on Cross Question, former Cabinet Minister Anne-Marie Trevelyan, pollster Scarlett Maguire, and former Conservative Special Advisor Tom Skinner. And at 9, Tom Lockyer is the captain of Luton Town Football Club. In December last year, he had a heart attack on the pitch. He received CPR and is now part of a British Heart Foundation campaign to increase CPR training. Have you ever needed CPR? And how has a heart attack impacted you and your family?
On your radio, on Global Player, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 7 o'clock, Joe Biden has renewed calls for a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah as he confirmed he's sending a few thousand additional troops to the Middle East to boost security. There are mixed reports that Israeli troops are about to launch a limited ground incursion into Lebanon, and it could happen as soon as tonight. Andrew Mitchell, Shadow Foreign Secretary, is told tonight with Andrew Marr he doubts Israel will do as Mr. Biden asks.
At this moment, having a ceasefire when they've got Hezbollah on the run would seem to me to be a very surprising course of military action.
Well, Jeffrey Feltman's a former US ambassador to Lebanon and told Andrew Marr there's a clear split between Hezbollah and the Lebanese government.
Hezbollah has said that they will continue to fire into Israel despite the losses until there's a ceasefire in Gaza. The Lebanese government is now saying we want to be part of the implementation of that Security Council resolution from 2006, which is clearing the area of southern Lebanon from all armed elements except for the Lebanese armed forces.
After more than 100 years, traditional steelmaking in South Wales has ended this evening. The last furnace at Tata Steel in Port Talbot has shut, with the loss of thousands of jobs. Alan Davis, National Officer for Steel for the Community Union, told LBC he can't believe it's come to this.
It is difficult, more difficult than what I thought it would be. And yeah, it's devastating for the people that work inside there. 2,000 people in Port Talbot will be displaced and families demolished. It's hard to comprehend at the moment.
And Councillor Rob Jones, who's leader of the Labour group on Neath Port Talbot Council, told tonight with Andrew Marr this will affect the entire community.
Although Port Talbot existed for many, many years, it has been built up and known as Steel Town. There is not one person that you can speak to is not some way connected with